The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from teenvogue.com. Our first article today from teenvogue.com, RFK wants to send people to wellness farms. The U.S. already tried that. This article was written by Catherine Waring on April 17th. In a clip from a July 2024 virtual town hall that recirculated online earlier this year, now Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. argues that the U.S. should combat addiction by opening wellness farms to help people get off of opioids, antidepressants, and stimulants. Kennedy says people taking medications for conditions like depression and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, along with those living with addiction, could spend 3 or 4 years growing organic produce on these farms to be reparented and reconnect with communities. RFK Jr. went on to declare during his confirmation hearing for the HHS secretary position that a healthy person has 1,000 dreams, while a sick person has only one, implying that the only dream a disabled person can have is of being cured. And in an April speech addressing the epidemic of autism affecting U.S. children, RFK Jr. claimed, "Autism destroys families. These are kids who will never pay taxes. They'll never hold a job. They'll never play baseball. They'll never write a poem. They'll never go out on a date. Many of them will never use a toilet unassisted, and we need to put an end to it." Repeatedly, the man leading the nation's health department has affirmed his view of people with disabilities as a burden. Online, some users have compared RFK Jr.'s vision of wellness farms with Nazi concentration or Japanese-American internment camps. Few, however, have made the connection to the disabled colonies established in the United States during the 19th and 20th centuries. In short, America has already tried wellness farms. Beginning in the 1890s and continuing through the first few decades of the 20th century, epileptic and feeble-minded colonies sprung up around the U.S. The initial purpose of these colonies was to remove patients from overcrowded, badly run asylums and poorhouses in favor of farm life, where they would have access to the outdoors. Under the colony model, patients generally lived in cottages designed to be more home-like than institutional. Patients were also given jobs, and many were expected to work on colony farms, where they grew their own food. Dr. William Spratling, the medical superintendent of the Craig Colony for Epileptics in New York, declared that the farm model meant, "Nature, the great restorer, will have an opportunity to do her best." It didn't work. Supporters of the colony model argued that, with time, clean air, sunshine, a restricted diet, and physical labor could heal patients of the medical conditions that ostracized them from society. But that didn't happen. Data from the Craig Colony, one of America's first epileptic colonies, opened in 1896, illustrates this point. During the 1940s, thanks to funding and staff limitations because of World War II, conditions in North American institutions were particularly grim. The institution's 1993 to 1994 annual report to the State Commissioner of Mental Hygiene shows that less than 1% of patients were discharged as cured that year. During that same period, over 200 patients attempted to leave the colony without permission, and over 5% of the total population died. If the goal was to actually segregate disabled people from public life, you could say the colony model succeeded. As Michael Rembis, associate professor and director of the Center for Disability Studies at the University of Buffalo, wrote in the Oxford Handbook of Disability History, the physicians, social workers, and state officials who ran colonies and other institutions for disabled individuals were driven by an ableist logic that was always infused with racialist, gendered, and class-based thinking in their attempts at segregating, sterilizing, and generally restricting the world's disabled population. Colonies also assured that disabled people would be shielded from public view, similar to the 19th and 20th century ugly laws that made it illegal to exist in public spaces as a person with a visible disability. In the early 20th century, epileptic and feeble-minded colonies became hotbeds for eugenics. In 1924, a teenage girl named Carrie Buck was institutionalized at the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded after becoming pregnant outside of marriage. In part because Carrie's birth mother had also been institutionalized, the medical superintendent of the Virginia State Colony sought to have her sterilized, so she wouldn't pass down her alleged mental defect to any additional children. The resulting court case, Buck v. Bell, went all the way to the Supreme Court, where Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who wrote for the majority, declared in reference to Carrie, her birth mother, and Carrie's daughter, that three generations of imbeciles are enough. In the end, Carrie Buck was sterilized against her will. Buck v. Bell was never overturned, and 31 states still allow the forced sterilization of disabled people, according to a 2022 report from the National Women's Law Center. Across the country, up to 70,000 forced sterilizations took place throughout the 20th century, per NPR, with many of them occurring in colonies and other institutions. Rather than focusing on curing patients, colonies became about control. Control over who got to live in communities and who didn't. And control over who would have the opportunity to have children. RFK Jr.'s fixation on wellness farms also risks stripping disabled Americans of the right to choose how they live their own lives. In 1999, the U.S. Supreme Court declared that disabled Americans have the right to live and receive support in their communities when medically appropriate, rather than be forced into state-run institutions. Although RFK Jr. maintains that admission to his wellness farms would be voluntary, the Trump administration has essentially labeled people with disabilities, chronic health conditions, and neurodivergence, as well as the essential medications on which many of them rely, a threat to national security. This language makes it clear that disabled people are not welcome in his new Make America Healthy Again era. Perhaps, then, it shouldn't be surprising that under the Make America Healthy Again mantra, we are seeing a resurgence of eugenicist talking points and attempts by lawmakers to strip back disabled people's rights. Last month, as The Guardian reported, a University of Texas at Austin-owned venue hosted a natalism conference featuring a number of controversial far-right and eugenics-aligned speakers who promote high birth rates. In her Disability Visibility column for Teen Vogue, activist Alice Wong has called mask bans the new ugly laws. And 17 state attorneys general are currently suing to fight the inclusion of gender dysphoria in a list of disabilities protected from discrimination under Section 504, the legislation that mandates any organization receiving federal funds must be physically accessible and provide accommodations to those who need it, and that sets the foundation for the Americans with Disabilities Act. The lawsuit also challenges the constitutionality of Section 504, which many disability activists and legal experts fear could overturn protections disabled people rely on. For the disabled patients forced into colonies during the 19th and 20th centuries, life was not easy. In addition to forced, unpaid labor and the risk of sterilization, patients sometimes underwent experimental treatments and lived in overcrowded conditions. New York's Craig Colony was so chronically understaffed that, as of fall 1943, over 30% of the colony's total positions were unfilled. Overcrowding became so severe at Craig that a 1944 state report described some buildings with conditions not duplicated in any other institution in the department. In one house designated for men deemed mentally incompetent, the report found that nearly 200 patients walk up and down the day room with no place for most of them to sit except on the floor and nothing to keep them in the least occupied. In a corner closet are piled 60 mattresses foul with the smell of urine, waiting to be laid out in rows on the floor of the day room when evening comes. In this building, young boys are herded together with middle-aged and old men, all of them mental incompetents and some admittedly sexual perverts. The contrast between these crowded buildings and the cow barn, where the dairy herd of the institution is kept, is marked. The cows are kept in clean, spacious quarters, well provided with fodder, while certain of the wards of the state in this institution have lived and slept under conditions which members of the commission felt could never have existed in a civilized community. Wellness farms aren't about wellness at all. In practice, history shows us they're about eliminating disabled people from public life. In 1899, the Craig Colony's Dr. Spratling proclaimed, "Epilepsy is not so much a disease that can be reached with a single drug or the contents of a written prescription. It is more a condition that pervades every part of the human economy, a condition that needs to be eradicated, educated out of the system, so to speak." Compare this to RFK's assertion that disabled people taking psychiatric drugs should learn to get reparented. When a statement from the U.S. Health Secretary in the 21st century sounds like a quote from 1899, I'd argue that's a return to eugenics, not an endorsement of modern science. Even if colonies did somehow cure patients, disabled people deserve to choose how they live and to live with dignity. Disabilities don't ostracize the vulnerability from society or keep them in conditions worse than cattle. People do. What if, instead of upholding toxic wellness culture, we reject the eugenicist beliefs underpinning Make America Healthy Again? As disabled activist Leah Lakshmi Piepsna Samara Sina said, "We can still dream a future where disabled people survive, but more than that, we lead, we shape the world, we create futures infused with disabled knowledge and ways of living and imaginings." Our next article from TeenVogue.com, FSU shooter shows radicalized white men are the threats to college campuses, not student protesters. This article was written by Lexi McMenamin on April 18th and There is a note. In this Teen Vogue take, news and politics editor Lexi McMenamin analyzes the April 17th Florida State University shooting and the politics of alleged gunman Phoenix Ickner, 20. A few Augusts ago, the day after a hurricane passed through the area, I drove through lush, green Tallahassee, past Florida State University. I had been interviewing local students and residents, mostly at Florida A&M University, the historically black college nearby. Local classes were canceled because of the storm, and as I rolled by FSU buildings, saw the porches were filled with students that could have been pulled from a Bama Rush TikTok, the portrait of a stereotypical white college experience. Following yet another school shooting, this time at FSU on April 17th, a 20-year-old junior who witnessed Phoenix Ickner open fire told NBC News that the shooter was a normal college dude. Two people were killed and six injured. To that student's point, the alleged gunman is a quintessentially American school shooter, a radicalized young white male who, classmates told NBC News, espoused white supremacist rhetoric. The son of a longtime local sheriff's deputy, according to NBC, he used one of his mother's guns to commit the shooting. At the sheriff department's press conference about the shooting, Leon County Sheriff Walt McNeil told media that Ickner was a long-standing member of the office's Youth Advisory Council, and that, due to his training, it was not a surprise to us that Ickner had access to a gun. So, just to sum up the state of things in this country, the American government is so hostile to immigrants and those sympathetic to Palestine that it is deporting them, snatching them off college campuses, and separating them from their families. Meanwhile, the real threat to college campuses are people like the FSU shooter, who, a fellow student told NBC, had been kicked out of a campus debate club over his white supremacist views. Per NBC, Ickner was a registered Republican, and in a January story in the school newspaper, FSUnews.com, he ridiculed anti-Trump, pro-Palestine protesters. These people are usually pretty entertaining, usually not for good reasons, the gunman said of those protests in the story, which NBC reported has since been removed by the student paper to maintain ethical journalistic standards and avoid amplifying the voice of an individual responsible for violence. Florida, not its residents, but its politicians, breeds mass shootings, to the extent that multiple past shootings in the state haunted yesterday's violence. The shooting resulted in the cancellation of a memorial scheduled for that day for FSU senior Maura Binkley, who was killed in a 2018 Tallahassee shooting by a man with a history of misogyny. Survivors of the 2018 Parkland shooting were also on FSU's campus as the shooting shut down school grounds. FSU, I'm so sorry our government has failed you, Representative Maxwell Frost, Democrat, Florida, the first national organizing director of March for Our Lives, the anti-school shooting group that formed after Parkland, posted on Blue Sky in response to the news. Meanwhile, Trump, who was president during Parkland, responded, "It's a horrible thing. It's horrible that things like this take place," adding, "The gun doesn't do the shooting. The people do." Insert here that Onion headline about this being the only country where this regularly happens, I guess. While I was on that reporting trip in 2023, three people were shot and killed in Jacksonville. At a protest on that trip, Florida organizers argued that the issues they were confronting were all connected. suppression of campus protests, and overzealous policing. The arrests of students protesting Governor Ron DeSantis' anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, pushes in higher education, five of whom faced felony charges, later dropped. The state's efforts to disenfranchise black voters and erase black history and LGBTQ plus people. That summer, the NAACP issued a travel warning to the state for those populations. Back then, Florida students and organizers asked me to tell readers that what was happening in Florida was coming for America. It was only a matter of time. With Trump's reelection, we've seen the adoption of so many of the policies piloted in states like Florida, including the dismantling of DEI programs and legislation targeting trans youth, some having been orchestrated by right-wingers like conservative education activist Christopher Rufo, creator of the anti-critical race theory panic. Instead of meeting the moment, or even identifying these problems as the threat they are, we've got the New York Times hosting Rufo on its Tentpole Daily podcast, and Democrats begging for a left Joe Rogan to regain young white men voters rather than actually protecting the marginalized communities in their base. I think of those idyllic campus porches at FSU, crowded with kids celebrating, then think of the footage of the abductions of Rumeysa Ozturk and Mahmoud Khalil, both of whom expressed support for Palestine as students and now remain in custody. I think of police rushing to FSU's campus to stop a shooter allegedly trained by cops to shoot. Then think of 20-year-old Juan Carlos Lopez Gomez, a U.S. citizen who, CNN reported, was detained for entering Florida from Georgia while commuting to his job in Tallahassee. Gomez was released Thursday night after a night in jail. FSU student Reed Siebold knew Phoenix Ickner from a school club where they discussed politics, a club Ickner was ultimately asked to leave, Siebold told CNN. He had continually made enough people uncomfortable where certain people had stopped coming. The shooter, Siebold claimed, would make comments beyond conservatism and about the ravages of multiculturalism and communism and how it's ruining America. Siebold, who was the club's president, told NBC News, "He espoused so much white supremacist rhetoric and far-right rhetoric." Siebold was on campus working on a class project when the shooting began and had to enter lockdown in the classroom. "I was texting everybody I loved, letting them know that I loved them. I was getting ready to die, which was harrowing," he told NBC. "I don't know why he would have done something like this. I don't know where it would have come from, but I'd sure like to find out." Another former classmate, Lucas Luzietti, was unsurprised when he learned Ickner was the shooter, given things he said publicly, reported USA Today. Luzietti told the outlet that the gunman espoused right-wing conspiracy theories and hateful ideas, claiming, "I got into arguments with him in class over how gross the things he said were." Luzietti told USA Today further, "I remember thinking this man should not have access to firearms, but what are you supposed to do? His mother was a cop, and Florida doesn't have very strong red flag laws." According to the New York Times, authorities have not yet revealed a motive for the shooting. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Bernie Sanders makes surprise appearance at Coachella. This article was written by Marilyn LaJeunesse on April 13th. Coachella's star-studded surprise guest list just got bigger. Ahead of Claro's set at the Outdoor Theater, Congressman Maxwell Frost and Senator Bernie Sanders shocked the crowd by making a brief appearance. This country faces some very difficult challenges. The future of what happens to America is dependent upon your generation, Sanders said. You can turn away and ignore what goes on, but if you do, you do it at your own peril. In addition to warning festival-goers of the challenges ahead, the Vermont senator urged the crowd to stand up against the Trump administration. The crowd booed at the mention of the president's name, prompting Sanders to say, "I agree." Sanders went on to denounce the president's statements on the environment. "He thinks that climate change is a hoax. He is dangerously wrong." And prompt revelers to stand up for women's rights to control their own bodies. His speech also touched upon the urgency of fighting back against billionaires, touting health care as a human right, and hailing Claro for her own advocacy work. Claro has used her prominence to fight for women's rights, to try to end the terrible, brutal war in Gaza, where thousands of women and children are being killed, he said. So I want to thank Claro not only for being in a great band, but for the great work she's doing. Ahead of his surprise appearance at Coachella, Sanders held a record-breaking crowd at his Los Angeles Fight the Oligarchy rally. Joined by New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, the duo saw at least 36,000 people, a career high for both politicians. Power, greed, and corruption are taking over our country like never before, AOC said at the LA rally. Sanders echoed his Coachella statements, calling out both Elon Musk and Trump. They've got billions and billions of dollars, and it's not enough. They need more. And if they have to step on the poor and the disabled and working class people, that is what they will do unless we stop them, and we will stop them, he said. Sanders also urged people to make this revolution with joy. We're going to sing and dance our way to victory against hatred and divisiveness. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.